name is Kevin Cahill. I'm a journalist, and for some time I was the deputy editor of the Sunday Times Rich List.
So, what period was that, and who were you working with?
I was working with Philip Beresford, and that was in 19... That was at the start of the Rich List, the first three editions, issues.
Yeah, which year? What years?
1989, 90 and 91.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because this is the period I was at the BBC as well in London. And I was watching journalism turning round, you know, so various good people being elbowed out and nepotism bringing all sorts of completely inappropriate people from the world of advertising and things like that into doing editorial roles. But anyway, I think it's a good idea to start by looking at how the Rich List has changed and who might not be appearing on there that should be.
Yeah. Well, the early Rich List, the first seven, had the Queen as the richest person in Britain. And around about 1996, Murdoch intervened, having had, he said, a phone call from the palace. The palace claimed to Murdoch that the Queen's wealth was being based on public assets, not private ones. And at the time, it was debatable. It wasn't clear who owned the Crown estate. But in the first year of the coalition government, in 2010, while they cancelled student grants, they also conferred formally on the Queen, and of course now Prince Charles, the ownership of the Crown estate. So the question is, who owns the Crown estate? And the answer is King Charles. And the Crown estate is worth between $8 billion and $13
billion. Right. Well, there is also the matter of freedom of information requests, because royalty seems to exist in this kind of bubble. It wants to be public. Obviously, they like to be in charge and in control, sending letters to ministers and appointing ministers and this sort of thing. And as well as, of course, army officers and police chiefs and judges and this sort of thing. But they don't want to be open to scrutiny through freedom of information. And we do know that whilst he was Prince Charles, there was a lot of letters, these black spider letters going between his office and ministerial offices. I mean, that is a bit... I would imagine that this sort of thing is still going on, but the law made it impossible, changes in the law, for people like Rob Evans at The Guardian to actually publish stuff about these letters, even if they got hold of a copy.
Yeah, I mean, the system at the top here is fiddled. I mean, apart from the ownership of the Crown estate, which is now fixed. There's no debate, no, you know, two ways about it. And it belongs to the King, and that makes him worth $8 to $13 billion. There is the issue of the Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Cornwall is worth between $1 and $2 billion. Very conservative estimate. But that belongs to Prince William. And he's not even in the Rich List. So the fiddle goes on.
Are there any other figures that might be supposed to be on that list that aren't there? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of senior bankers in the City of London.
Most of them keep their assets offshore. And the list is anomalous because at the top of the list are a lot of effective foreigners, and nobody knows where their assets are. Most of the really rich keep their assets in British offshore tax havens, Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, and so on. Most of those offshore tax havens are actually Crown assets. The person who owns all the land in those tax havens is the king.
Well, it's interesting because it's almost like all roads lead to Buckingham Palace or Highgrove House.
Well, they do. They do. And there's no, I mean, there's no public accounting for this. And by accident, the Sunday Times Ritualist is, you know, takes the place of proper accounting. But the list after Murdoch's intervention in 1996 has always excluded the royals. And the issue, a lot of the people at the top of the rich list don't say where their assets are. Most of the really rich, and it includes a lot of the American rich, keep their assets in British tax havens.
And, do, I mean, surely the rich list people can track that down, can't they?
No, you can't. It's an incredible effort to find out who owns what in a British tax haven. Some of them have limited disclosure, but they don't tell you, you know, that Hinduja keeps $20 billion of his assets in the Cayman Islands. Nobody knows where those assets are. And the editor of the Sunday Times is estimating and guessing. The cost of trying to establish where the assets are, well, they don't have a budget anymore.
Well, okay, so the whole thing it sounds like a bit of a fiction.
Yeah, I got away with it because I was looking at funny, odd things, land, which was extremely difficult to establish in those days, and I was looking at the tax havens. But the cost of doing one tax haven, which was where the Guinness money was, it took months, cost a fortune. The Guinness family keep their assets in Switzerland. And, you know, one of them is the Duke of Ivy is mentioned in the rich list further down. But there's no indication of where his assets are held.
Yeah, well, it seems to me there needs to be a specific note attached to the rich list in big purple letters saying, well, this is just a guesstimate. The other thing is, we've just had this week, Kevin, in Bristol, a big protest outside our Bristol City Council demanding that the council stop using their bailiffs to collect council tax from people who just don't have any money to pay council tax. They're being demanded to pay it, and the council are sending their own bailiffs around or employing bailiffs to do it. This is for people with actually no money at all. Now, for these people with the billions, the billionaires, the trillionaires, what about, I mean, how much tax do they pay?
In most cases, none. If your assets are held in a British tax haven, first of all, they're not disclosed. In most of the tax havens, the Caymans and British Virgin Islands, you cannot get disclosure. And most of the tax havens impose no tax at all. So the really rich never see a bailiff. And in any case, it's worth checking that you cannot notionally, in British law, be prosecuted for debt. And bailiffs, in effect, are breaking the law. They're prosecuting for debt. And it's a perversion, another perversion of the system. And so far, there's no sign. The Inland Revenue told me a couple of months ago that the total losses to the United Kingdom by just four companies, Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Facebook Meta, to a dodge they use. They're using the Republic of Ireland as a tax dodge. And the United Kingdom loses, wait for this, $13 billion. And the revenue had its staff cut by the Tories, and the Tories effectively handicapped the Inland Revenue and didn't let them investigate the what's called the Irish double dip.
Well, it almost sounds medieval. It's like time for the Robin Hood and the super rich, the king, the government are like kind of the Sheriff of Nottingham. But he does appear, doesn't he, this year in the Rich List, King Charles, and he's doing quite well.
It's a guess. The private kind of shares and things of the king are not known. It's a guess estimate. Back when I was doing the Rich List, you could talk to people at Barings Bank in particular, and you could get, not on the record, but you could at least get a reasonable estimate. I'm not sure the list even does that. But by ignoring what the Crown and the Duchy of Cornwall owns, it makes the list completely ridiculous. And I mean, Murdoch himself isn't on it. He, again, no one knows where he keeps his assets, but he's an American citizen and he spends an awful lot of time in the UK for, a non-dom. But anyway.
So King Charles has increased his net worth by £5 billion. This is after he inherited everything from his mum with no tax, no inheritance tax at all. So he is doing quite well. Whereabouts do you think he should be on the list?
Well, going back to the original list, he should be at the top. The Crown Estate knocks out most of the top people on the list. And I think it's quite suspicious that all the people, or most of the people at the top of the list, are effective. Nobody knows where they live.
Right, they're sort of like dual citizens or triple country passports.
Passports a la carte. Which one is it today? The Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands.
So Charles is on $13 billion at the moment. If you add the Crown Estate to that, how much do you think he's really worth?
No, the Crown Estate brings him up to 13.
Oh, does it? Okay.
It does, yeah.
Right.
But the ownership of the Crown Estate was fixed by the same government that cancelled student grants.
Well, Charles will say that the Crown Estate is just held in trust for the country, not just his personal property.
That is simply not true. The coalition government, I'm not sure they actually passed it through Parliament, but they made a bit like Trump's presidential decrees. They simply announced that the Crown Estate was now the property of the royal family. So there's nothing to kind of debate. How much is the Crown Estate worth? That's the minimum value King Charles is worth. How much is the Duchy of Cornwall worth? That's the minimum that the Prince of Wales is worth. And I don't think he's even on the list.
So what can we do about all this?
Well, your good folks up in Bristol beating down the doors about bailiffs beating up the poor unlawfully. I'm reasonably certain that proper interpretation of British law about being imprisoned for debt would stop the bailiffs. Because what they're doing, in effect, is convicting you of debt when you have no money. And you can't do that under our constitution, the unwritten one. And you can't do that under the European Convention of Human Rights. Now, have you noticed who's trying to kill the European Convention of Human Rights?
We've got something like 700 people living in vans here on the Downs in Bristol. It's starting to make the national news. There is a definite housing crisis. It's caused in lots of different ways, largely by inexorable rise of rents and landlords who are saying, well, if you can't pay it, I know someone else who can. Evictions on the rise, and also, of course, you've got the added pressure of the 750,000 or so migrants into the country every year, keeping that housing bubble pumped up. Maybe you could just tell listeners a bit about your books, what the titles of them are, and how to follow your work.
Well, the simplest way to follow the work is to insist that the land registry brings itself up to date and says who owns the biggest states. And Parliament needs to pass a law saying it doesn't matter if the estate is allegedly owned in the British Virgin Islands or Cayman Islands or Switzerland. You pay your tax here. And, you know, when the person in charge of the estate dies, they pay their inheritance tax in Britain on the whole estate. It's a long-term problem and it's not going to be solved quickly.
Can you just give us the titles of your various books, please?
Oh, yeah. The first one was Who Owns Britain? And that was the first time ever that the second doomsday was brought back into the public realm. The next one was Who Owns the World? Which, even if I say it, it was the first such book ever attempted. And it was a miracle it ever got published. And what was the third one was Who Owns Ireland? And again, it's only when I was writing the book, I noticed it, that all the big landowners in Ireland were, or most of them, were living in England on the rents, and they were, the majority were old Etonians. There's a problem with Eton, the school.
Well, it sounds almost like nothing's much has changed since the time of the Irish famine.
The Irish famine was critical. The people in Ireland learned that if you didn't own your farm and you could get kicked out at the will of the landlord, you couldn't live with that. So what they did was they threw out the landlords. They said, fine, you know, if our survival depends on these wankers, and that's the only possible word you could use, then they go. It's our country. But the curiosity was that when the Irish Free State was created, the Crown's assets weren't transferred to the people of Ireland. They were transferred to the Irish state. Now, that's never been imposed in Ireland. It's kind of ignored that freehold isn't freehold. You're a tenant of the state. But it comes as a terrible shock to the average Irish audience when they're told your freehold isn't ownership. You don't own the farm. The state does. Anyway, nothing's ever been made of that.
Well, I mean, it's a similar thing in England, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, here's the oddity. I mean, here in the United Kingdom, we've got population of whatever it is, 80 million, and we're a fairly well-industrialized state. But we are something like number 18 or 19 in the world ranking of countries by GDP. GDP is the total income of the country divided by the number of people in it. It's a pretty, it's a rough guide, but it's a good guide to how the stuff is being shared out, the money. And in Ireland, a tiny place that is still heavily agriculture, is number 2 or 3 in the world ranking. The long-term effects of kicking the landlords out and taking over ownership is an extraordinary and almost never commented on difference between the UK and the former colony.
So what are you saying about Ireland then? Is the quality of life any better, do you think?
The better it gets, the more the Irish whinge. That's what a friend of mine in Dublin said. But based on the global statistics, Ireland is doing far, far better than we are.
Yeah. Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, Tony.